The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Well, hello, Brand Family Realm Network, Russo's crew. Are you feeling it? It's Goldie's Closet episode 75, and I'm excited to reconnect with somebody, wrestling's power agent. From my TNA days, I would have gotten to know this brilliant, articulate, humble, and talented man better, like a limp female version of Tosh.0. It's Goldie's redemption. So please put your hands together for our warm Realm Network, Brand Family, Russo's brand, round of applause, power agent, Mr. Bill Behrens. Yeah. What is up?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly. How are you? You look the same as you did when I knew you back at TNA. You haven't aged.
Yeah, well, I have. Yeah, that's it. Actually, I get to, this year, I'm 64 in October, so I get to play the Beatles song.
Which one? Are you friends with Vince Russo? Are you guys good? Do you have heat?
No, it's just when you still need me when I'm 64.
I know he's a big Beatles fan too. So,
well, who isn't? I mean, you know, from my generation, if you weren't, I think that they, you know, wanted to kill you or something. It was like a law. You had to start with Elvis, move on to the Beatles, and then maybe you did, you know, the Rolling Stones if you were a rebel.
If you're a rebel, yeah. I love it. And I have just had such a great time reading about you over the last few days and listening to interviews. And I wished I could, you know, you can only listen to so many interviews in a day when you've got the next person and the next thing to prepare for. And I was absolutely fascinated by your story and your childhood. And I want to talk a little bit more about that just because I never quite get enough of it on the interview. You were like, oh, this is the quick Reader's Digest version of it. And then you go on to things.
I've had multiple lifetimes because I had one career in television.
Yes.
And then that translated to a second career in wrestling.
I mean, and it just blows me away. And I always tell everybody, this is sort of my limp dick Tosh.0 version of my own redemption. Like I kick my ass for myself daily, probably 10 times thinking, you know, I'm listening to you and I'm like, why didn't I become friends with, you know, better friends? Of course, we were always cordial and my head was so far up my ass in the TNA days with the dumbest stuff ever. And now I look back at all of these amazing human beings such as yourself. And I just was like, why weren't you sitting down and learning and talking to? So I guess 18 years later, here I am, like, apologizing.
There's nothing to apologize for. You and you went out the hard way because you went out with a concussion.
I went out, well, a concussion, and then I got canned, which is so funny. And listening to some of the stories.
How dare you get concussed?
No, but, you know, the real reason that I went out was, and I mean, it's water under the bridge, and I'm cool with it, and I've run into him since then, but, like, when I started working with Vince Russo, Vince and I really hit it off because at first we did not hit it off because he wasn't as gentlemanly as you were to me. You were always amazing. And Vince was always like gentlemanly, but you know, he was like, okay, you're going to do this angle where you go into the ring and then you're going to take a bump and then your shirt's going to fall off. And you know, I always tell that story. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that.
That's not what I'm doing. It was before Vince found God.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and then he was like, oh, okay. So now you're going to take a bump, and then, like, your shirt comes unbuttoned, and then your bra is exposed. And I'm like, no, that's not. And ever since that point, like, we weren't great friends, but, like, we were looking at each other, and we were watching. And then when he started to see some of the, you would get this more than anything, the stuff that Trinity and I were doing just with a camcorder running around Venice Beach in L.A., like, funny shit, girls behaving badly. He started to want to put that on. Even when I was like, Vince, I don't know if this is funny enough to put on the pay-per-view or whatever, but he wanted to put it on. And like, we connected in a way like that. And I know that that amount of TV time did lead to my demise because the boys were like, why is she getting so much time. And you know what? If I was a worker back then or even now, I'd be like, why is that person getting so much time? And then, you know, lies get spread, which we'll get into because I was listening to your Hannibal interview just about, I don't know who this guy in your history is. We'll get to him. Bill, another Bill that just seems to be talking all this shit about you. And I love hearing when stuff's being thrown at someone, Bill, because you are so articulate and your details, they just line up. And even when you were talking about like jimmy rigging the lighting, you know, with the halogens and everything, and you're like, this is about $300 as opposed to this, like, your shit's always like everything I've
listened to. You're talking about Billy DeMott when I worked, when I went back to that for those terrible 3 months at Deep South Wrestling.
That's what I was like, who is this Billy guy? Because anything that he's said about you, it didn't really line up with, like, you're just a facts guy. Like, dude,
it's really cool because he wrote a book. And, you know, of course, I any book where my name is in it is, of course, the greatest book ever written. But even still, he had all this stuff about me, and it, you know, like, we can go into this if you want to. But
I'd love to because I love it.
At one point in his book, he went, well, you know, this guy Behrens came in, and he supposedly like produced 1,000 or more hours of television and blah, blah, blah. But I had, you know, and it's like, okay, yeah, that's why I was hired before you were by WWE. It's why I was hired before Jody Hamilton. And if my building hadn't been a piece of crap, you guys might not have even been hired. Because the original plan was they were going to do the TV in my building in North Georgia, which Tommy Dreamer loved. Fit Finley came and looked at it. Everybody loved the building. And Dreamer said, this is freaking awesome. Vince will hate it.
Because it's not shiny.
No, yeah, it wasn't shiny. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't new. So instead, they hired... hired Jody Hamilton, he hired Billy DeMott, and they went down and found a building down in southern Georgia. And it was a nice building, were it not for the fact that nobody had decided to do any due diligence, including WWE. And there are these pillars all over the place holding the roof up, and somehow you have to figure out how to get a ring in. You know? Just an idea, like, if you're going to do a training center and a TV show, you need a ring. Then you got to actually have the room to put in bleachers and seats and ramps and lights and all that shit. And again, there's marvelous stories in wrestling, of wrestling stupidity.
What was the place with no restrooms and no, like, it said you
said? That was the building when I first started working in Cornelia. When I first went, I was running at a flea market in Loganville after having worked with Bert in Nashville for a while after WA went out of business. When I first met Bert, Jerry Jarrett came to me when I was working for him at USWA and asked me to put Bert out of business. That's how I met Bert. I called a TV station to tell the TV station that we'd prefer his TV show not be on the station we were on. And then, I ended up going into business with Bert. Why wouldn't I, right?
No, it's just so fascinating how you are just such a self-starter and somebody who self-corrects, you know. And I wish that I would have known you back then. At least I get a chance and a shot to hear your story now. There's so many people that self-sabotage out there, and I love talking to them right now if they're listening.
It's called wrestler brain.
In
the wrestling business, I refer to it as wrestler brain, is where no matter what good you could possibly do, you find a way not to.
But that's, Bill, that's everybody in life. That's everybody wanting to start a small business or ask somebody out or whatever. There's always all these, there's that old, you know, not old saying, but you see it online a lot on a meme that just like don't, something about why ask the question, like, why can't I, like something about like, why can't, like, you flip it so that you're basically saying you look for all these reasons why something isn't going to work. What if it does? Why? What if it doesn't? What if it does? Like, and I think many people are terrified with that. And I love your humble beginnings, you know, with your family, which it doesn't sound like it was very humble. If you had that many stations and you did the numbers that I've heard that you did back then, like, that's a big, big deal. And to go in, like, were you going in cold to stations and just knocking on the door and saying,
Yeah, my dad, who was tremendously talented in a variety of ways, but he was primarily a salesperson that decided he wanted to be a producer. And I said I'd never want to work for the company after having been in production with him, because that was carrying a tripod around and setting up a Niagara tape recorder, and it was mind-numbing. And I wanted to be a lawyer, so I'd actually gone to law school, and then I realized that that involved studying and stuff. Which after going to college, I decided I didn't want to do any more of. So I went to 1 year of law school and then went to work at a TV station and then moved back to Atlanta. I was also freelance writing for local Atlanta, the weeklies like the Gazette and Creative Loafing and people like that. I started in Emory, where I had 12 jobs, including being a campus cop.
Shit.
I was the stoner campus cop. And I had joined the newspaper, which was the editor of the newspaper is a guy named Mike Sager, who's a very talented professional writer with multiple books right now. He wrote the article in Rolling Stone or Playboy, Rolling Stone, I think it was, the John Holmes article that eventually became Boogie Nights.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, The Devil and John Holmes was the article, and he's done a bunch of stuff. I mean, he's spent time with a schizophrenic Rosie Barr and just all sorts of fun stuff. Oh, okay. He's an immersion writer, so if he goes and he gets with a drug gang, he's with them. You know, he gets in, and, you know, if they're doing the drugs, he's going to do the drugs. It's, you know, he's that guy. You know, very, Hunter Thompson, the Gonzo journalist, I don't know if you're familiar with Hunter, but Hunter Thompson loved him. You know, the guy that Johnny Depp acted in one of the films, and Billy Murray did a film about him.
Wow.
Anyway, whenever you want to get started, we can get started, because we're bouncing all over the place already.
No, I love it. I wanted to talk about, like I said, when I was talking about the self-sabotaging, you have this history in television, and then you start in television, and you made a really good point about your father being a salesperson, but then
He took me on the road for 3 days. And then after we finished appointments in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, he said, okay, I'm flying home. You're on your own. Good luck. And, you know, and it was like, Dad,
were you scared?
Of course. I had no idea what I was doing. I had done one convention where they had come to Atlanta for a convention, a TV convention that's called NATB, the National Association of Television Program Executives. And Mom and Dad, because it was a family deal, they didn't want to bring, they had a salesman working for them. They didn't want to bring that guy because they had sort of lost, you know, confidence in him. So my dad called and said, hey, what are you doing? And I said, well, not a whole lot. I'm, you know, lucratively hired as the manager of a U-Haul dealership right now, Dad. So please let me do anything else. And so he said, you know, come down. You can hang out with Mom and me and I'll do the pitches. And you can just keep all these, you know, general managers and program directors happy. And, you know, maybe we'll see what happens.
So
I learned the pitches. And then when it was over, this was back in the day, I mean, when broadcasters were broadcasters and decisions were made by the local stations, you went in, you talked to a guy, he made a deal. You didn't go to a corporate office. There weren't 900 stations owned. There were restrictions on that. It was a much more creative business.
Relationship-based.
Yeah, right. You know, and I had come out of, prior to that, I'd been a concert and record reviewer for the papers. That's when I started working for Mike.
Okay,
and
I don't know this.
That, when I was back in college, I had a band where I got to be the shitty lead singer and stuff like that.
I didn't know that either. That's awesome.
Yeah, I did a band both in high school and in college, but the one in college already existed. I just showed up at a fraternity rush and they went, and I saw a guy over playing piano and he was playing 50s music, and I went over and he was playing, I don't know, it could have been anything, Blue Moon. And I started singing it. And he went, you know Blue Moon? I went, yes. I had a ripoff Sha Na Na band. You know, Sha Na Na was a ripoff band. We ripped Sha Na Na off. You know, so I had Little Stevie and the Starlights in high school. And then I had the Grease Band. We just called ourselves the Grease Band. And I was the front guy for both bands.
Did you ever sing in your TNA days? Did I miss that? Because I don't remember.
Yeah, I never sang. I just they had me doing bad acting for a while. I was playing goofy characters because Jerry liked to see me take bumps and, you know, get my pants pulled off. Like, I think we actually had our first not our first meeting, because our first meeting were promos with the Dubs.
Oh my God.
I think that was the first promo, because you were interviewing them. And then I came in and did some authority bullshit thing and went out.
Not to drink
and then
beer.
Maybe that show or the next show, we had Jim Miller was the NWA president at the time, big dumb guy. And and I mean that only in the nicest sense of the word dumb. But he, they had done this thing where they found him tied up with FU on him. So they said, okay, we need to do that with Bill because we don't want Jim to talk. And that was the deal, is they didn't ever want Jim to actually appear on camera in any way substantive. Just didn't think it was good. So anytime there was, okay, you know, Ed Ferrara needs to spear somebody, send Bill out. You know, we need somebody to cover up that girl's breasts, send Bill. You know, we need to tie him up, take his shirt off. And that's when I met Vince Russo. Literally, I think I posted this a while ago. It's like I was sitting there, somebody posted the picture of you hovering over me with FU on my bare chest. By the way, I had shaved so that you could read the words. And he walks in, I'm hogtied.
Yeah.
And the first time I ever met Vince, first words is, we need his pants off.
Oh.
And I went, nice to meet you too, Vince. That's
like,
you see, he wanted you to lose your top. He wanted me to lose my pants. It was a great way to meet the man.
Oh, Jesus Christ. It's so funny, Les. Who was I talking to? I did a podcast last night for a great, you know, wrestling podcast. Mm-hmm. And they just were saying, like, they're watching, very nostalgic. They're watching all the old stuff now is new, coming back, as you know. It's everywhere.
Yeah. Well, the early TNA stuff was actually really fun. If I'd made money doing it, I would have had a ball, but I was losing money because I was driving. We were only doing the one show. They ended up paying me less than they had promised to pay me and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. And then there was just stupid stuff like the fine girls that are willing to stand for a two-hour show and dance in a cage half naked, you know.
Is that your responsibility to find those?
No, I did not have to do that. My responsibility was booking Explosion. I booked all the extra talent for the company. But I wouldn't get anywhere near that one. And any time I had to tell them to do something, there was only one, I forget the girl's name, there was only one girl that had even the beginning of a brain that we got dancing. And I think she was the one. My bet is that the spot where Vince wanted you to lose your top, they ended up having one of the girls in the cave end up doing the spot.
Yeah, I almost punched her. I remember that very clear. Yeah, I
remember her name. She did other spots
Lollipop.
Too. Lollipop.
Yeah,
she was the only one that like seemed to want to do stuff.
She did. I gotta tell you, like, I can't. It's not a good idea for me to get into this. So how can I just say it politically correctly? Bill, I've been just biting my tongue like for weeks now, and I just have to keep my big freaking mouth shut. But like, how can I flip it? I will say this. I will make this statement. You're an intelligent man. You can read between the lines. One of our friends, a very great worker, called me a couple weeks ago to apologize. As last night, the podcast said, you know, Goldie, all of the things that we're watching, they wouldn't fly today. And didn't that make you upset? And didn't, I'm just going to say this. When this person called to apologize for all of the promos and the spots that we did, I told him to shut the fuck up and sit down. And he was like, he was ready for me to blast him, but he was pleasantly surprised because I said, so-and-so, number one, I signed up for professional wrestling. Number two, I'm a grown ass woman. Number three, I'm in entertainment. Number four, I signed up for professional wrestling. So when I say I wanted to knock her out, it was because I didn't want to do the spot. I didn't think it was necessary for me. So they find some other girl to do it. And then, okay, do your spot. But then go backstage and act right. And she wasn't acting right. And I just remember thinking, I'm going to knock the shit out of this girl. Because she was standing there next to Jerry Jarrett with her tits hanging out. And she was just like looking at everybody like, look at me. I walked over to her with a robe. And I said, bitch, put this fucking robe on now and stop disrespecting and embarrassing the rest of the women in this locker room, be it Desire, Trinity, my friend, I said, we're not acting like that. So stop. And then you go fast forward to all these years later and there's, I just act right. That's all I got to say. And then
we had a lot of good times and a lot of good stuff was done in those early days. It was also very dysfunctional. There was, and I mean, from a management standpoint,
I get that because anything else.
And one of our top guys, without, you know, being specific, but you'll know who it is. One of our top guys was, you know, juggling cocaine and beer to try to walk a straight line. And
that's every business, though, with wrestling. That's not just TNA.
It was also, you know, when I worked for Universal Television, I had a sexual harassment moment to me, to the point where I didn't do anything. This is exactly what happened. I was given a supervisor who literally was the caricature girl that, oh, you know, she gets a lot of deals, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, on her knees, right? But the reality is she was a over-the-top alcoholic, and yeah, that is how she, I mean, she'd get her deals done with the general manager drunk off his ass and after dinner, if you know what I mean. So he became my supervisor, and I was all about, and I was, and I, at the end of my term with Universal, I was offered a very lucrative package. I said no to. They told me I was their best salesperson, highest percentage of clearances, and I traveled 1 to 2 days a week to do that. They wanted me on the road 5 days a week for the money they were paying me. And I said, why? They said, well, because everybody else is. And I said, that's fucking stupid.
Yeah.
And why are you, you said I'm your best. Yes. I do it this way.
Yes.
And you said it's what you want. Now you want me to do it somebody else's way? Well, that doesn't make any fucking sense. Well, what had happened at a party, we'd had a meeting, and this eventually had me called into human resources when I decided not to take their really nice deal because I'm dumb. And, the girl came up. There were three guys she was managing and her. And she's sauced. She's over the top. And we all know she's sauced. We just want to get through this. Go ahead. She's going to give us a pep talk. And she started really pissing me off. And ever since I had worked for one company in show business that went belly up because of the barter marketplace, the commercial marketplace going bad, and all of a sudden, no money. And next thing I know, I don't have a job and I'm owed money. But I went, okay, I'm going to set up my own company, Show Business Inc. No longer ever going to be employed just by one person. I'm going to be employed as much as I can, because the more employed I am, the less unemployed I am.
Absolutely.
So you know, it's, you know, have a side gig, always be doing something else, stay busy. And so I, you know, I was, even then, when I was an officer at Universal Television, simultaneously, I was an officer in two other companies and was running other product through my company, including professional wrestling. And Universal wanted me to drop all of that to take their exclusive deal and do it their way. I said no. Well, anyway, at this meeting, she pissed me off. She said, well, you know, if you all don't work better, if you don't do better, you know, me again, I've cleared everything, and she's bitching at me, and I'm getting madder and madder. And, you know, she's saying, you need to do this, and we need to do this, blah, 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 blah. And I went, look, whatever your name was, I can't do that. I said, here's the deal. If you're going to continue to suggest that I can be fired if I don't jump on your joyful bandwagon here tonight, cool. See the guy right over there, our boss. Go over to him. Tell him you want me fired right now, because I already have three other jobs. Don't need this fucking job. And she then, drunk off her ass, grabbed my hand, brought it to her bosom, and held it there.
Bill, I want to just...
and began going, we all have to work together. And everyone, the other two guys are looking at her, looking at me, looking at her hand, looking at her, looking at me, looking at her hand. And it went on for 5 minutes, where I literally was not allowed to remove my hand from her breast the entire time. I'm just literally like...
I swear to...
It was great. So when I went to Human Resources, this is the end of the story. They said, so we heard about this story, Bill. And I went, yeah.
Oh, no.
And I said, did this happen? And I said, yes. And she did that. And I said, yes. And I said, and she's going to do it again, because she's a drunk and she's going to get you into trouble. But that's, you guys know it. and you're putting up with it. And, you know, if she fucks you, she fucks you. But, well, what did you think she was trying to do when she grabbed your hand? I said, I don't know, what, Bond maybe? I have no idea. And they said, would you sign a release? And I went, sure. I'm not going to, think I'm going to sue you over your stupid, you know, hiring a stupid drunk person? I don't like suing people. I went to law school. I hate lawsuits. I've been sued twice in wrestling, and both times were mind-numbing. I hate lawsuits.
I don't like that story, and I don't
It's terrible, but it was funny at the time because the human resources people are going, oh my, and their brain, I can see their brain working where they're going, he could sue the fuck out of us. You know, and this is way before it was fashionable for everybody to bitch about everything.
Thank you. Yeah.
You know, now we bitch about everything. It doesn't matter what happens. And if it didn't happen, fuck it, we'll make it up. You know.
No, and that's why I just go back to saying, like, act right. And I said last night when they weren't asking about anything with the speaking out movement. They just were, you know, I think I brought it up and I just said, like, I want to go on record on every possible podcast that I can. This was a big one. I want to go on record as saying 0% of men ever did anything to me at all. Everybody acted with the utmost respect from me. From first off, they think it's always going to be when I tell one story, they're going to think it's a wrestler. It's like those guys treated me like fucking gold. They treated me like their sister, like their.
You're in music, so I mean, you're around. I mean, I've been around the music business and the entertainment business and Hollywood, and entertainers, performers in general are fragile. A large percentage are extremely fragile people, and
many
come from extremely fragile backgrounds. Yeah. So if you're not, you know, or if you're, you know, if you're blessed to have somebody that, you know, grounds you, which some people get, and it's, you know, takes a while for some. I mean, I know that.
But then there's also a thing of just knowing right from wrong. And when people would invite me places, I would, you know, we all went to the ale house afterwards. We all did our thing. But when it was time to go do blow in somebody's bedroom, I was like, oh, I'm tired. I'm going to go tap out. And honestly, it was the AJs and the Chris Daniels and the CM Punks and all those guys that usually after ale house or whatever, like they'd go back to the hotel, even though we had checked out. You either went to the strip club, you went and did coke up in somebody else's room that still had a room. You went to the pool and slept out on the lawn chair until we went to the airport, or a lot, like I said, the guys that I just mentioned, they went to the gym, which I should have been going more. Like those were the pockets of things that I knew better, even though I probably could have kept my job longer or whatever. Like it's just, I know it's probably not a good idea to go compromise myself in a situation. Or another odd thing is I remember like some of the conventions that we would go to and we'd fly out and a lot of the girls would, I'm not dissing them, I'm saying like they stayed for their shift. And then they went out and partied. And when it was time to go, Bill, I always said, there's people coming in, like, I'll stay. And they're like, but you're done. And I'm like, but I'm here and you paid my plane and my hotel and you're paying me very well to be here. And I would stay till absolute close because
it's the same thing. I got mad when I was a syndicator at a convention and a guy that's now a Hollywood agent to me was irresponsible because, you know, he went and hung out with some of the stars that we had in for the convention, which I did too. I mean, I went out with the supermodels one night and went to a strip club that I ended up leaving because I didn't have enough money to actually participate. But nothing more embarrassing than being taken to a private room at a strip club where all of these people come in ready to lap your dance off and realize that if you're going, it's okay, I'm fine, I'm okay. They're either going to think, oh, he's, you know, or... You know, but what they really don't know is that in my wallet, I have like 10 bucks, and which is worse than being impotent. You know, it's like if you only have 10 bucks in a strip club, you are in real trouble.
Oh, my God.
It's not like you can give it to somebody like an arcade and they all of a sudden click out quarters for you. You know, it's like it doesn't work that way.
Well, now you can with all of them.
And all these girls, there was Tara Banks and all these other really hot girls. They were all having a wonderful time and they're just throwing fucking money around. And, you know, and so there's two options. One, sit there and get more and more humiliated, or go, okay, I had a good time. I walked down the French Quarter with all these hot girls. That looked good. let's say I have to go to the bathroom, and trust me, they're not going to miss me when this is all over. At this
exactly.
point.
So is that what you did, the bathroom gimmick?
Yeah, I did the bathroom run out. Yeah. And got back to the hotel, and I had worked the next day, so it was smart. But that same night, another guy had gone out, gotten way over the top drunk, you know, that I had heard about, and then showed up to our meetings and our presentations and what we're there to do, what we're being paid money to do, drunk off his ass, hung over badly, and not really able to do shit. And you know, so I went to the boss and I said, okay, this is fucking stupid. What, I mean, why did you hire somebody like that? Well, you know, I have to understand that he's got, and he had a feeble excuse on it that I know he regrets now. But, you know, what I didn't know at the time is that he was an alcoholic. My boss was an alcoholic, too, at the time. So I didn't know that. So he had more sympathy for the spot than I was aware of. But anyway.
We got off on this branch with the wrestler brain sabotaging. And we talked about the early days and just, like, people not making good decisions and whatnot. You segued into the wrestling business from... Let's talk about that. So now you're doing the stuff with your dad. You learned all of the pitches. And I didn't know, like, when I'm reading about you being wrestling's fake lawyer, well, you went to law school. That's not even fake. So that doesn't even – that gets –
Yeah, I did the first year. First year of law school sucks because what they want you to do is you have to read a certain amount of cases for every course. You have to be prepared to recite, which means that – at any time you're supposed to be called on, and you need to be able to answer questions off the top of your head based on the reading. You have to have known the citations. You have to, you know, you've got to, and you have to be ready all the time. Fortunately, I'm a speed reader. So,
really?
And lazy, which is a combo, good combo package when it came to studying at that point. I was much more interested in, I had found a friend that played a guitar, and we would just go party and sing for a while, and then I'd wake up the next day and go, oh crap, I've got classes, don't I? 8 a.m. torts. Oh shit, that's when I learned to drink coffee. And you know, so I learned though that I could prep the first case and then speed read the other cases while somebody else was getting grilled.
Oh my
god.
So
if I got called on, I was ready. And you don't get called on that often when it's a big class. But to give you an idea of where my skill set was, and I realized it, you know, well before the year was over. My friend Mike Sager, the writer, went to law school too. He quit after the first quarter. He was smart. I went a whole year, and but the only A I got was in oral argument. And that one was where they put us up and they did a mock presentation where you were given a case. This guy argued. I argued. And I was able to pull out of my brain, because I have good short-term memory, or at least I did then, I was able to pull out of my brain all this really esoteric citation garbage that no one should have ever remembered from the reading. And I'm watching the judges, and they're sitting over there going, holy crap, where's he pulling this shit from? And, you know, so that was my A. Everything else was a B or a C, and I realized, okay, if you graduate law school and you're a BC guy and your skill is talking – the only thing that's going to end up happening is you're going to become a criminal lawyer and you're going to want to kill yourself. So, and I had realized by then that the Perry Mason thing really didn't work, where like you always had an innocent client and the guy that was guilty always broke down on the stand. And it didn't work that way. So that's when I gave up and went to work for a TV station and did voiceovers for them for a while. And
I had
an idea at the TV station. This was a cool idea. This is 1979, give or take. Went to the manager, Randy Corley, NBC station, and we had a guy, Dave Plyler, who was a radio disc jockey. He had a great radio voice. He liked my voice. I used to work the front desk, and he used to always have me page him arbitrarily during the day just so he could hear his name over the intercom. And but I said, you know, I have an idea, because I'd done concert and record reviews, and I was friendly with a bunch of people with CBS Records, RCA, and, you know, all the labels, because I'd, you know, been supporting them for a while and, you know, interviewing their stars. And they had just started doing music videos. CBS had just done a Journey video.
Really?
An extended video for Meatloaf, Bat Outta Hell.
Yep.
And one other one. And there was literally the beginning of videos, and they had no idea what to do with them. and they were sending them to college campuses to run in the wherever the community center was.
Okay.
There was a TV, and you could put a VHS tape in.
Wow.
And you could play your stuff. Well, and I'd seen the videos, because they brought them into Emory.
This is so crazy. I don't even remember things working like that, but no, I guess.
It was nothing. There was no support at that time, which is why, honestly, local papers and writing reviews was so important.
Wow.
And getting that record covered was important. I mean, part of the reason record albums still have mystique is the artwork, the size, and the ability to be drawn to it, which, CDs had to figure out how to keep up with by doing long boxes. So I ended up going when I was at Emory, when I was in the tail end of my law school thing. So I went to them and said, okay, I know there's more videos now because now there's another year, a year had passed since I'd left Emory. Then let me call my contact, Debbie, at CBS. And let me see if I can start getting her. And if I can get her, then I can get everybody else to start sending me these videos. Why don't we put Dave Plyler, who's a DJ anyway, in a studio? If bands come into town, I don't care what the genre is, doesn't really matter. We're in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, could be anything. Doesn't matter. Bring him into the studio and tape interviews. And in between, have Plyler be a disc jockey and run these videos. And Rennie Corley said, hey, that's a pretty cool idea. Can you get it set up? And we had time set, and it was going to be a late night show. It was going to be great. And I called Debbie and got her on the phone, and she said, oh, one problem. I just got promoted. I'm moving, and I'm no longer able to help you. And the person that's taking my place is an asshole. So I went, oh, sweet. And that was my in. Everybody else was going to be uphill fight because, again, nobody knew what to do with these things. Well,
you're so good at that, though. You're so good at coming up with your problem solver.
Spin forward, and this preceded MTV. MTV happened after my failure, but the idea was so logical. The fact that MTV said, hey, let's get these, let's call them VJs. What a crazy concept. And next thing if you had a music video, that's how you popped your song.
Nice.
But before that, it was all radio play. And it was all reviews of concerts. It was touring, it was radio play, and it was reviews. And the visual was less important. And then all of a sudden videos came in. All of a sudden the visual became more important.
Yeah, video killed the radio star.
Yeah, very much so.
Segue into that, here's how dippy I was. I didn't know that you were coming up from Georgia with AJ. So
yeah, actually, David Young, when David did his, he was talking about all the guys he drove with. What David forgets is, and he was talking about the time that he and AJ almost died while they were driving. Remember he told that story of them playing video games and like, that was actually us. I'm driving. I had an SUV.
Oh yeah, David Young was talking about you a ton.
Yeah, but he had his trips all wrong because, David is great because, as he says, if the stories are true, that's great, but otherwise they're great stories.
Yeah, exactly.
There was a group that went up, Elix Skipper, myself, David, AJ, and if that group wasn't going, then there was another group, Andrew Thomas, who was one of the referees and eventually became one of the editors.
Light.
And Rick Michaels, who did a little bit of wrestling with Chris Michaels as a tag team, but was the guy upstairs doing wrestling gear. So we had these groups that would drive together. But the one time AJ, David and I are going, and AJ and David are sitting in the back. So I'm literally chauffeuring them. It happened to be a somewhat rainy day. We're going around the loop in Chattanooga.
Yep.
Just about to head up over the mountain.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, I hit a slick part. I knew my tires weren't great, but I didn't know they were this bad. And next thing I know, I have no control. And this is rush hour. There's cars everywhere.
Oh.
And all of a sudden, we're sliding to the right. And the guys, all of a sudden, everything starts moving around. They go, what the hell? They're yelling and they're screaming. And I managed to control the vehicle. We slid back the other way. And we slid between two cars somehow. And I managed to get off the road. We had a minor problem with one tire that had to get fixed. And so there was two things. One, I had them get out of the car and go look at it, and they said, well, we're going to need to, you know, we can drive it, but we're going to need to get to a shop. So we did. And then David's line was, well, thank God we were with AJ. At least we had Jesus with us. So we had that. And then there was the very first time we ever had a stardom moment with TNA, because at the beginning, nobody was watching the frickin' pay-per-views. We show up at this place to get it, and like any car place, no matter when you show up at a place to get your car fixed, it's never convenient for them.
No, of course.
No, it's this is going to take forever. You know, no matter what it is, you need your window cleaned. I don't know, could be 3 days. And so we pull up, and the first thing they're all doing is, oh, we can't, oh, no, I mean, oh, geez, you're going to be here for, well, it could be years. And, you know, and I got a production meeting in like 2 hours, and I'm going, guys, and, you know, I think phone, we had cell phones, not sure there was texting at the time. I forget the exact timetables of when technology went into play. But all of a sudden, AJ walked in to find out how I was doing negotiating our rescue, and I wasn't doing well at all. All of a sudden, the guy went, holy crap, it's AJ Styles.
Nice.
And I went, yes, it is. And we really need to get to TNA for the, oh, you're doing the pay-per-view. Oh. I'll watch you. And I went, you're the guy. Sweet. And next thing I know, boom, all these other people are sitting there being told their car will never get fixed. We're squared right to the front of the line. So that was our first moment of fame with TNA. AJ's second moment of fame that he called me from the road on was he called and he said, Bill, I just got recognized at the airport. I said, cool. He said, yeah, I went to get a piece of pizza and the guy gave it to me for free because Aww. He knew who I was.
I love that.
We lived through them playing games and nothing got broken. And I made it to the production meeting in time.
I had no idea that you guys were all doing all of that, like, and how smart to save money and to pool and to do all that. Where did you all stay? Who was I talking to? Lenny Lane and Alan.
Yeah, I literally drove back because I was still working other stuff.
You did?
So I literally would drive back after every show and get home at like 4:30 in the morning.
All of them?
AJ would spend the night sometimes. Every once in a while, Ryder would let me get a room. If he knew we were going to be there extra late, Bob would get me a room.
All of you.
And eventually when we started flying back and forth on the little airplane, I always got a room when I came back, because by the time we got back on the airplane, I was dead. Plus there were Heinekens on the flight and, you know,
we went back to the wrestling brain, to self-sabotaging. What is it about you? How do you? What goes through your mind when you recognize, because it sounds like every room that you walk into, you recognize an opportunity and you seize the moment. And you come across, again, like I said, very humble and very good. Not like, how can I take advantage of it? I don't get that at all from you. I get like, wow, lawyer brain setting in. How can I do a deal here? How can I finesse something? Like, is that because you have that personality, that lawyer personality, or was it your dad's training with hustling like that?
It's a little bit of all of that. My dad was very much, you know, you work for a living. From 15 on, I had to have a job. Summers, you didn't screw around.
No. Oh, okay. That's your dad. I got it.
And, you know, it's when I was in college, freshman year, he said, okay, I don't want you to get a job, blah, blah, blah. I want you to work hard. And I thought I was working really hard. And I'm smart. You know, I know I've got a brain. And I was not doing great. I went to Mike Sager, third time I've mentioned him. But I went to Sager because he's smart too. And I went, what the fuck am I doing wrong? You know, I know I'm studying. I'm spending a lot of, he says, I can't tell you, but you'll figure it out. And it's not going to be something big. And it's not going to be, what it was basically relaxing, realizing I really wasn't studying. I was spending a lot of time, but I wasn't doing it right. And figuring out how to, you know, as we say in wrestling, work the gimmick. You know, what do you need to do to get the job done? You know, if you're in a course that requires memorization, you got to memorize. But if you're in a course that requires you to just have a brain, don't overthink it. Try to learn around the facts so that you can talk about it in a class. If it's a class where you can get over on talking, then do that. And once I got out of the, you know, memorize these things and then regurgitate these things, which is the worst kind of teaching, then I was doing great in school. And from that moment on, I also was living in a fraternity my freshman year, which was unheard of. And I was in the best room, the only one with its own bathroom. It was like the, you know, yeah, exactly. It was, trust me, I was doing a lot of work and a lot of other things. So I really wasn't, you know, doing what I needed to do. I was wasting my parents' money.
That's a lot of people.
Which is bad because, you know, my dad had told me going in, he wasn't sending me to college to learn necessarily a trade or anything. He said going in, college is where you learn to think. And it's what I've tried to explain to other kids that are going to school or even when they're going to wrestling school. The process is getting comfortable with it. And that's when the learning begins. If you're just doing, you know, 1-2 cha-cha-cha and whatever you do, you know, if it's being trained in wrestling and all you're doing is learning the moves, or if you're being trained as a musician and all you can do is, like my sister, musician, my sister can play the piano beautifully. When I was in a band, I came home and I wanted to practice some of the songs. And I can't play anything. I can play chords on the piano. That's it. But I've got pretty good pitch, and I can tell if a harmony part is right or wrong, stuff like that. And I can arrange a song, but I have to have somebody where I can sing the parts, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Michael Jackson, I'm not pretending I'm that talented, but he did the same thing. He couldn't read music. I couldn't read music. My sister, though, reads music, plays beautifully. If I wanted her to play a beautiful piece of music and I could sing along to that, she'd go note for note perfectly. I came home and I said, Melinda, I want to practice, I'll just make a Teenager in Love, which is C, A minor, F, G, F, G in the bridge. And I said, can you play that? And she went, C, A minor, F, G, A, F, G. How do I do that? What are the notes? And I went, well, those are the chords. Just set up a rhythm down here and then play up here. And, you know, because I'm the piano player I had in college, all I had to do was go, okay, do this. You know, can you change this here? But it was easy. For my sister, who can read music, play beautifully, that part of the trigger, she was never able to turn that on. And the part of what I learned my role is in a lot of things. Like when I was pitching TV shows, everybody used to memorize the presentations, go in and do the presentation the way they were told to do it by the company that hired them. I never did that.
You felt it.
I went in and I asked questions rather than presenting. And I learned about the person I was talking to and what was important to that person. And I made sure I knew enough about that person's station and schedule that I could intelligently talk about where that person had problems on their schedule. And then it would get down to my show, and the question inevitably would come up and be, you know, is this a good show? And I said, well, I don't like it. And they go, you don't like it? I go, no, but this is television. This is an art form. I don't like reality shows. I don't like soap operas. I don't like this. I don't like, there's a lot I don't like. That doesn't mean it's not going to reach an audience. The fact that I don't like something doesn't matter. The fact that you don't like something doesn't matter. You've got to look for, does this fit? Like, if I've got this show here, will this show follow that show and flow?
Yeah.
If I've got a wrestling show, can I put another wrestling show after it? Because one show into another show works. So that was then. When you get into wrestling, it's the same idea. And it's where I learned my only skill was. I'm a terrible promoter, but I'm very good at recognizing talent. I can't train anybody to do wrestling moves. I'm not a wrestler. I've wrestled, but I'm not a wrestler. I can't do what I teach, but what I can teach people to do is don't just go out there and dance. Don't just go out there and do the moves, because what separates the artists in any performance art form, and wrestling is a performance art form. In fact, my selling TV shows, what is at times a performance art form, you're in a performance art form, and there's tremendously proficient people, but if all they have is proficiency, all you're getting are fireworks frequently. And that's where wrestling has that problem too. You're getting these wonderful, spectacular moves, but you're not getting storytelling. You're not getting emotion.
No.
You're not getting passion. The best bands are the ones that have a chemistry between the people and the audience, not necessarily the guitarist with the greatest pyrotechnics.
No,
if you've got George Satriani in your band, nobody else is going to get seen or heard because all he's going to do is do the same over-the-top riff for every song.
And jizz all over everything.
Yes, and at the tail end of it, the crowd will be going, whoa, that was cool. And then nobody's humming it going home because you can't. You know, so in music, that's true. In acting, that's true. In wrestling, that's true. In, you know, sales, if you're doing it correctly. But if all I did was I learned a presentation and I regurgitated it, like there used to be this thing called flip cards we used to be told to use. It was a famous salesperson that hired me, Sandy Frank, and he was infamous for flip cards. Every card had a point. If you did the whole presentation and flipped all the cards, no idiot should be able to say no to you.
Okay.
And I would instead, because everyone knew Sandy, they knew I worked for Sandy, so they would say, are you coming in with a Sandy pitch? And I'd go, yep. And they go, really? And I go, yep. And you're listening. And I go, Bill, I don't want the flip cards. I go, I'm bringing them. I would walk in, and the first thing I would do was hold up the flip cards. And I'd go, we are about to do this right now. I'm going through every single one of these, and you are not going to leave this office until you agree. And he would look, they'd all look with panic. I go, nah, I'm not doing that. And he says, does Sandy know you're not doing the flip cards? And I go, no, I tell him I do them. And because I'm closing deals, he doesn't know better. So that was my way of finding a way to perform within what I was being asked to do in the presentation as a professional. When I got into wrestling, it's one of the reasons why I think Jerry Jarrett kept throwing me into acting stuff for TNA. Is I don't need to memorize a script. I just have to read it. And then I'm going to make the words true to me, which is, I used to screw with Jeff Jarrett all the time. And in fact, I'd had AJ do it one time and it was just wonderful to watch. Jeff was very, and one of the reasons he and Vince got along so well when they were at WWE is Jeff wanted to be written for. Jeff didn't like to be extemporaneous. Jeff liked a script. And Jeff would memorize the script. Word for word, which meant if you went off script with Jeff on a live thing, you would see panic go into his eyes. And I did it all the time with him. And he'd sit there, and you'd see him, if you watch some of these things, like I did the Cowboy Billy thing where I'd been hitting the hair head with the chair, and then I came out pretending I was the sheriff, new sheriff in town. And I go telling Skippy, Scrappy, Scrappy Puppy or something like that. And just making stuff up. And Jeff is having trouble not cracking up on me. But I made sure that my last line that preceded his next line
was his feed.
I always did so that he got his feed line. So I had AJ do the same thing. AJ was, you know, and Vince was bad on this and wrong because AJ had become a tremendous promo and he could have been a tremendous promo earlier if people hadn't gone, people from the South sound stupid. No, people from the New York sound stupid. AJ went out and did a promo. Jeff's in the ring. AJ's in the crowd and they're setting something up. And I told AJ, make the promo real. Do you know what the promo's about? And he said, yes. I said, fine, ignore the promo now, except for the line just before you feed it back to Jeff, and watch Jeff when you do it. And if you can find that tape, he's the only time AJ ever did one in the crowd, don't know what show it was on, but if you find the cutaways to Jeff, you will see panic in Jeff's eyes. And when AJ went backstage, Jeff's late wife, Jill, came up to Alan, one of the rare times she ever talked to Alan, and said, that is the best promo you've ever done. And the reason why, it was the first promo he had been allowed because I told him not to do what he was told to do.
Yeah, the flip cards are put away.
Go out script and be natural, which is what we had taught him in Wildside before, where we trained a lot of the young guys. I mean, Hunter Johnson, Delirious, who's the booker for Ring of Honor, got his start in Wildside and then came in. And Delirious was the guy with the mask that ran around like an idiot in the early shows. You may remember him. He came with Matt Sydal, Daisy Hayes, Spider Nate Webb, who was like in every match with the Three Live Crew. But the key was, you know, you've got to learn how to be natural. You've got to learn how to respond naturally, act naturally, wrestle naturally, tell a story naturally. Once you get to that point, you've moved from being just a performer into being an artist.
Interesting.
And there's a big difference. There's a huge difference between those two things. And a lot of people understand that. A lot of people go, well, I look great. I got a great beard wrestling. I got a great body. I got a great look. I can do all the stuff. Yeah, but if you do everything the same way all the time, I'll give you an example. Just stubborn people that didn't learn things and have won over time has actually just commented on recently on the Facebook. I remember Andy Douglas with the Naturals. Andy did one of my least favorite things in wrestling on a regular basis, which is the look at my hand north to south, slap my leg when I kick. And of course, kicks don't sound like slaps, but wrestlers, once punches started being slapped, where you go like that and you make noise, then all of a sudden every kick had to be a slap. And the slaps were, here's my hand, I'm going to hold it up and I'm going to show you my hand, then I'm going to bring it straight down and I'm going to hit my thigh when I kick. Look at my hand, I'm making noise. At that point, you've so far gotten away from being an artist. It's ridiculous. You aren't learning it. Abyss, wonderful performer. Abyss had to be taught to do less because he wanted to bump his ass off for everybody. He wanted to be this gigantic guy that a little guy could knock on his ass with a fly swatter because he was generous. He wanted to give, but that's not an artist. Just the fact that you do the bumps doesn't mean you do the bumps. And that's where I learned my skill was. My skill was, A, and this is another thing I know you can relate to because it's true in any performance art, and I know you've seen it. There are people who become great over time and figure out the system. Mm-hmm. Then there are people that the first time they walk out, you know they're something special. And you just hope that that fire is going to keep burning long enough for it to get realized and it's not going to burn itself out. And that's sort of what I learned in wrestling is I can tell with almost anybody by the way they come out the curtain the first time and within a few moves of what they do in the ring, whether they've got potential.
Okay.
That's where I learned my skill was.
Time out, because you nailed two of the things that were on my list of questions. So I will say top of the hour. This is Goldie's Closet, episode 75. We are with Realm Network brand family, none other than wrestling's super agent, Mr. Bill Behrens, who without me even asking questions, because I had two to wrap up the hour with, one of the questions was, what do you look for in talent? Like, how do you recognize? So let's reiterate that again, because that was a really big question that I had on the list is, you just know it, Bill, when you see it. What are some of the traits? What are some of the characteristics of somebody that you know from being a super agent and a star in your own right? Like, what are those things that you know, and you just know that they're a star?
Well, the hard part is that a little bit of it is, yeah, what do record producers always say? They get a gut feel.
Yeah.
But it is very much like that. And I think it's true for, you know, a director in Hollywood when they find an actor that works well within what they do and is basically singing the same song. But what I look for is not the moves that wrestlers do, but how do they connect with the crowd? And right now, that's more challenging than ever because we don't have crowds. But that is still, we're a performance art form. We're an aggressive soap opera performed live and improvised from beginning to end. Wrestling is unique. The closest thing to wrestling is improv comedy. There is nothing else that's even remotely comparable, except here's your premise in improv comedy. And with a lot of improv groups, much like in wrestling, over time, some of the improv pieces become set pieces. And set pieces get done all the time and get played with. You play off the riff, you riff off of it. Same thing in wrestling. But you've got to, the same thing, what you have to do is, can you improvise? And in the process of improvising, regardless of the argument, and I used to have this argument with Vince a lot, as did many people, because he's wrong. But he's wrong because he was being narrow. And that is, he said there's no such things as heels and faces. You may have heard this from Vince.
No, I didn't. And
he's wrong in that, well, if you mean we're now talking old school 1960s and black hat, white hat, cowboy, you know, kind of deal. Bad guy, cowboy's always black hat. Good guy's cowboy's always white hat. That kind of generalization. Yeah, there is that heel and face dynamic is harder to realize now because in other performance arts, heels and baby faces were muddied by our willingness to embrace anyone's inherent ability to be good or our hope that they will be good. So, for example, is a vampire a heel or a baby face? By definition, the vampire was always a heel. He's going to attack you. He's sucking your blood. He's going to make you into a vampire. He's not a good guy. Then all of a sudden, there were sexy vampires. And all of a sudden, the vampire is a sensitive, lost soul that if only he could, would love the girl. And now the vampire is a baby face. So is a vampire a heel or a baby face? The answer is, depends on how the vampire's booked. And that becomes the challenge in wrestling, is who am I? And the quicker you realize who you are, the quicker you can actually realize a career in wrestling. And who you are is, I'm the guy that does all this flashy shit, then you aren't anybody. You're a fireworks display, which means, you know, everybody's going to love all the fireworks, and at the end, they're all going to go, woo! And then they're going to drive home, and they won't be able to pick out any individual firework because none of them resonated. It was just, this happened, this happened, this happened. At the end, all shit went crazy, and yay, it's over. And we went home.
Yeah.
Whereas if you tell a story or you find a way to get the crowd into the moment, ruling suspension of disbelief, you can in that moment be hated by that crowd, regardless of whether you're a traditional heel baby face, you know, caricature. You can get the crowd to want you to come back, which is the goal of the babyface. The goal of the babyface is to come back from odds. It's, you know, it's, which is the same thing. And, you know, if you're watching Die Hard, you want him at the end to make a comeback and kick the guy's ass finally because he's been beat up and he's been shot and he's bleeding. Mm-hmm. And you want him to make a comeback. You want him to get the comeback and you want him to, and at the end, you want, yay, babyface over, you know, most of the time. Or you want the heel to go over in a way that you want that baby face to make a comeback. And that is true. And it was true when Vince was booking. And it was true when anybody was been booking, no matter what they say. And you know, an example would be when Vince was involved in the book in WWE, for example, even though he really didn't create the character. When Stone Cold Steve Austin became Stone Cold Steve Austin, he was a heel. And he went in front of Jake Roberts, who was strongly professing his being saved and being a devout Christian, regardless of his other demons and problems. And that's when Stone Cold did the, you know, not John 16, you know, it's you know, it's my 316. You know, I'm now going to make this personal. I'm going to rip the Bible thing off and I'm going to do it. All of a sudden, the crowd popped for him like a baby face. And it was a total heel moment. But it wasn't. It was a moment where all of a sudden the crowd embraced that and made him into a baby face. And the baby face, who was supposed to be Jake Roberts after the King of the Ring thing, all of a sudden Jake Roberts looks like an idiot for being the devout Christian, dumb as that may sound.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't.
When Vince would say this, we'd have these arguments in Bob Ryder's office. Young Andrew would be sitting, Andrew Thomas, no, Rudy the ref would be sitting over there typing stuff up. Bob would be at his computer changing everybody's reservations and Vince would come in and I'd sit in there and do stuff and Dutch would come in and do stuff. And the Dutch tells this story too. I don't think he doesn't remember I was there, but I was. But Vince came in and Dutch, and actually it was my argument that Dutch came in on, and I'm arguing with Vince about baby faces and heels, just like we're talking now. And Vince just gets very profound. He goes, no, there's no such thing as baby faces and heels anymore. The lines have been blurred so much, it isn't relevant. And I go, no, it's still relevant, Vince. And Dutch walked in at that moment, and Vince was, you know, about to leave because he had made his point, and by God, he wasn't going to change his mind. And Dutch said, Vince, I've been listening here, and I can give you an example. If you really want to read a book that explains baby faces and heels pretty well, just so you can get a better handle on the fact that there are baby faces and heels and, you know, yeah, there are gray areas, but this book will really explain it to you. Do you want to read the book? And Vince said, sure. What's the book? And he went, the Bible.
Wow.
You know, God in the Old Testament in the Bible was a pretty cranky guy. If you go back and read it,
yes,
you know,
he was.
Like if something went wrong, he'd go, "Oh, really? Pillar of sand to you, flood your butt. We're gonna, you know, locusts for you." You know, it's like, okay, we're gonna do what you say. We're good. He wasn't quite a baby face there. You know, it was in the New Testament they finally got a more traditional baby face into play. Yeah,
that's really interesting. That's a really, really amazing story and worth this entire podcast just for that nugget. Not that every single thing that you've said is just so, and I appreciate your time and letting us learn from, I mean, so much value in this, Bill. Like there's just, I just think for people, and one of the other questions that I was going to ask you before we wrap it up is just for people that are starting out in any business, let alone the wrestling business. You know, I always love to ask people with experience, like what their advice is. And you did give a lot of it. And the same advice that I would give in my mentor was Prince. And Prince taught me basically the same thing that you're telling me in a different way, not with the fireworks and what song are you singing on the way home, but you've touched on without saying it. It's so important. Like, it's not being the greatest singer in the world or the greatest guitar player, or whatever, but it's like, what are you doing to make this unit on stage in the ring? What are you doing to make this work and be sustain itself?
Yeah, Prince is a wonderful example because when he started, he was the band.
Yeah.
His first two albums were him.
Yes.
You know, playing everything. And were the first, you know, and I bought the first two albums. I was in early on Prince. Then all of a sudden, he smartly realized, you know, I really need to be able to perform. His early videos were just him, you know, wearing very little clothing, dancing. It's all he had. And it wasn't, you know, and it really, to me, it didn't reflect what I heard in the songs.
Okay.
I go back and watch his earliest stuff. But then when he realized, okay, you know what? I need to be a front man. To be a front man, I need to have an engaging group of people that can support that vision and keep up with me so I don't have to do everything, even if I'm doing it in the studio. And that's when, you know, all of a sudden, you know, he's got Jimmy Jam and he's got Sheila E. and he's got all the pieces come into play. And you've got a show. And he also smartly wanted to work with people he would challenge to become leaders in their own right. So yes, all of a sudden, two of his guys become two of the top producers in the business, you know, almost out of the blocks. Boom.
Yeah, everybody, you know, did.
Where it wasn't just like, here's my backup band. No, this is going to be a rocket ship for other success. And I'm the front guy of this piece. And then he used it thereafter once the people started leaving because he created an environment where they had to leave. I did this in Wildside. I used to tell the people, if all you do is become great here, you're never going to make it because I'm never going to be the guy that's going to pay you. So the same thing, even though I'm sure Prince was paying these guys all really, really well, at the same time, it's no, you need to go do your own thing, have your own career. I'll produce even your first album if you need it, Sheila. You know, I'll do that. And I won't do it with the ego like, say, Rick James might have done. I'll go out and do that job. And so people would leave. And then he'd go, you know what? I need to do something else that people aren't doing. I'm going to go with an all-female band. What the hell? You know, because it's going to be visually interesting. And it's going to allow me to tell my stories differently rather than just singing another song. And that translates into wrestling. The advice you have to give anybody coming in is, you wherever you start, you don't want to finish. You want to go outside of, you know, The Wizard of Oz is one of my favorite movies. The Wizard of Oz, I think, has two possible morals at the end. One, I think, is correct, and the other one, I think, is incorrect. And it's about the people to decide. But the one I teach as being correct is, I think, the lesson for anybody in a creative enterprise. The one lesson is, if you go out into the world from black and white and you enter into color and you experience flying monkeys and wicked witches and wizards and all of this other stuff, it's scary. It's dangerous. And it's nice and safe to get home, get to bed. There's no place like home, and all the people you're used to being around, there's no place like home. Or you don't appreciate home. You don't appreciate your beginnings until you go down the yellow brick road. You experience the flying monkeys. You experience the wizard. You experience all these new things, and you have to do it on your own. Or you find people to go along that road with you that are willing to drink your Kool-Aid and help you get to the end of the yellow brick road and finally get out, finally get home by clicking your heels together. And now you're home, and there's no place like home because of the experience before. You now can appreciate the beginning because you've accomplished so much more out there. And the same thing is true in wrestling. You know, you've got to go out there. If all you're doing is working 5 days a week to go and work for $40 in the ring to, you know, when a guy in the crowd goes, "You suck," and you yell, "You swallow," and that's your whole, you know, performance. You know, at that point, you've got a bad hobby. You know, you might as well learn fishing. You might do it better. But if you want to take the next step, and you want to get outside of your comfort zone, and, you know, it's all already in wrestling, you're predominantly, whether male or female, but males in the particular, you're basically going to the ring in a bathing suit, you know, speedos in many cases. You're about as naked as you can get in front of a whole bunch of people, unless you're a male stripper. So you've already got to have a different mindset for that to be comfortable, you know, for you actually to go, "Yeah, that's what I want to do. Yeah. I want people looking at my crotch. You know, that's what I want." And it's, you know, because you know that's part of the reality of it. So, but you've got to get to a comfort zone where you can do that, and then you've got to take it out. So, like, now I'm developing, when AJ finally got hired at WWE, there was really nothing more I could do for him. You know, we had done every, you know, we'd gotten to the point, he'd gotten there. And now it's, you know, go make your money and bless your heart. And it was a lot of hard work. And he, you know, had to live through TNA going to Hell in a Handbasket. We had to put him out on the road with Ring of Honor, New Japan Wrestling, and Independence, and recreate a career that got him noticed by WWE and got him there as a totally new star. And nobody during the 2 years before he went to WWE ever mentioned TNA.
Really?
And he was TNA. He was the guy that had accomplished everything in TNA, but he was there too long. And wasn't treated well, particularly near the end. So that's what I'm trying to teach now. I've got two kids I'm developing now. As a tag team, we call them Master and Machine. Marcus Cross, who's a fourth degree black belt, a legitimate master in karate. And Griff Garrison, who is a big, good-looking kid with, and they both have tremendous hair. And Griff has this long, you know, locks, just, you know, looks like, you know, somebody from an old Gladiator film. And Marcus puts his hair up like a Dragon Ball Z guy. And they're just visually striking. Step one, as soon as they come out the curtain, boom, you know they're there. Then they've learned to work together. They've learned to resonate with an audience. And they've learned to make people care about them. And they've done it as baby faces, primarily good guys, but also as heels. Because I've wanted them to learn both. I've forced them to talk, but I've also taught them not to do promos. Wrestlers have a tendency, and it's one of the downsides, and our friend Vince is an unindicted co-conspirator in this. The scripting of promos in wrestling done live is not good. It can be defended by the people that write them as we need to do this because not everybody can talk, but that's assuming that you have to totally, you know, much like there are some directors that if you don't do the script as written, they're going to really, you know, screw you. I'm the auteur. You're the actor. Do what I tell you. Then there's the kind that basically go, there's the script, but let's do alternate takes. Let's go off the script a little bit. Let's see, do you know this character? Have you figured this guy out? Mm-hmm. Frequently, those are the things that win awards, not the one that went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 through a script, mm-hmm. but the person that was able to feel it a little bit differently. It, you know, it's, maybe it can be true for a performer that finds a way to reimagine his or her own song over time. Mm-hmm. So that a song that started this way can become something else later and almost become brand new and resonate differently with people and maybe even cross genres as a result. Same idea. So with Marcus and with Griff, the challenge has been get them more places. So they started in North Carolina. Then they started working all the George Indies, went to Maryland, worked those, went to worked for a promotion out of North Carolina. Griff Garrison, Marcus Cross then had knee surgery, bless his heart. So he's out a little bit right after they were about to be hired by Ring of Honor. And AEW, thank God, is still doing shows in Jacksonville. I sent Griff down there, and he got over. They love him.
Of course.
And I can't announce that he's been hired, but if I could announce he's been hired, it would be a cool thing. So, but I can't announce that.
This has just been at, like, we're over our time by 18 minutes, and I could talk to you forever because you're just amazing. And this is more than I could have ever anticipated or hoped out of this interview. Like, you are just a vast bucket, if you will, of knowledge. And I'm so grateful that you took time to talk with us today. And I know a lot of people on Vince's brand will just really get a charge out of all of this. This has just been great.
Well, I've enjoyed the ones you've done with, you know, people I've worked with David, with, I saw you did ODB recently. She's awesome.
She was just, we had so many technical difficulties during hers. You remind me of John Arizzi's interview, like just very the same flow and so much history and things that he's done. And I mean, you're just such a brilliant man.
I work off of what Martin Mull used to call a puddle of consciousness.
Now I see why. Now I understand, like, I didn't know that you went to law school and why you were so articulate and so calm, such a calming force in the wild, wild west of TNA, just back there. You know, it was just a mess and chaos, and you were a very calming force. And again, I wish...
Spider-Nate Webb used to call me Ninja Bill.
Yeah, no, you were the best. And I wish I would have had my head someplace else. It took me a long time to, like, actually figure out where it should have been, but... All you can do in life is move forward. And
before we get done, I learned something because, you know, like you were nice enough to go look at some of the things that where I've talked about myself or people have talked about me.
Yeah.
And I went and reminded myself, because I'd only a vague memory of when you were in TNA. My memory was right, as it turned out. I've had a pretty good memory of, and I remembered the injury, and I remembered, you know, the stuff that you did with Abyss and the stuff you did with Alex Shelley that he was grumpy about. And I remembered all those things. But I didn't know, and I should have, how many performers for TNA, including Dixie, that you were for the music. That I didn't know.
I wrote it, too.
I thought that Miller did everything.
Oh, crazy. No, I ended up writing a lot of it. I ghost wrote, so I didn't get credit for it. And even now, like, it'll say one of the other writers and then it doesn't list me, but that's okay. Like, I don't like been out of shape. I wrote a lot of it. I sang a lot of it. And then ironically, some of the stuff that I wrote in the studio with one of the producers later on got cut up, like for Tara's theme song, where it's part of it's me and then part of it's somebody else singing and everybody's like, oh, and it's not me. But, you know, and I try to clarify that, but sometimes I just say thanks and like let it roll off. But yeah, I wish I was doing that again. I do it for a lot of other things now and then continue to write. And we nominated for a Dove Award this 2 days ago.
I saw that. And I mean, you were putting it over that Christian thing, not a Christian band. But I know AJ would be, you know, thrilled to know that.
I just
we've actually presented at the Dove Awards.
He has?
Yeah.
Oh, that's I'll have to tell him that, because every once in a while I message him. Yeah, like, you even know what it is. But I said, I was with somebody from the dub committee yesterday just saying, like, what do I do? Like, how can I get some more votes? And I would love to actually win it, just to show that there are people out there that necessarily aren't, like, of course I'm Christian, not of course, but I am. But we're not a Christian band, and I'd like to kind of show a lot of people that are out there, like, you can still be yourself and true to you, but, you know, have a spiritual relationship with the creator, whoever you believe in. Like, I just think it would be neat to win in that category, because it's unexpected, and I'm always somebody that cheers for the underdog. And
I've found that, and sometimes the genres are a mixed blessing. You know, if you're a Christian band, you're in a Christian genre, therefore everything you do must be Christian, no matter what you're playing. It's great. Whereas, you know, for example, my favorite, if you want to call it a religious song or not, but Howard Hewitt does a song called Say Amen. That is as brilliant as any gospel-esque song ever done by anybody in performance. And almost always, if I try to sing along with it, which is a pain because he has a much higher register than I do, and it is not in my key. But when I try, invariably by the end of it, I find that it's so emotional, you know, and that I think that if you want to couch something under, you know, positive music, Christian music, you know, whatever, it really it's. Rather than it just be, you know, trumpeting, you know, God, you know, over and over, it's more the positivity aspect.
Yes.
Is, you know, rather, it doesn't have to be, you know, a constant, I'm now going to Bible you to death, as opposed to, here are the basic, you know, here's a song that's going to explain to you some of the basic tenets of how you should live something in a moment.
No, I agree. I think you can catch more flies with honey. That's my
story. I think Vince made a mistake overwriting the two shows he did, for example, trying too hard to be too religious to the point where it zoomed over people's heads. You know,
he was excited. You know, he was a new person, a new Christian. Yeah. And
Terry Taylor and I had to figure out how to make those shows work. And it was, gosh, was that tough.
Yeah.
Which one did you do? The first one, the one where the ring was where the pulpit normally was? Yeah, when Mike Posey was at that one, he came up to me going, Bill, this is not right. The ring shouldn't be there. And I was just, I remember we had Sinister Minister, we had Jim Mitchell. We had to do a spot where he had to get a cue where he's up in the rafters and we had no communication. I remember that. Then we had Ron Reese, the frickin' giant, came out and was supposed to strap one of the referees, and it was supposed to be Posey, and then I guess Andrew decided to take the strapping, and frickin' Ron just got into whipping the crap out of the people, and it's like, oh my god. And by the way, I'll leave you with this, because this is my story from that show.
Yes,
you remember there had this buffet before the show where you know, all the church people did a buffet, and you know, it was lovely. Everybody was very nice. And the show itself was fine, except it also, it was one of those at the end where all of a sudden they're going, if you liked this, we want you to go to the other room where we can indoctrinate you into this. And I was going, oh Lord, I need to get out of here. So I did. I got 5 minutes down the road and got so dizzy and sick that I almost passed out in the middle of the highway. I had to pull off the side of the road. It was a cold night. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
I rolled the window down, and I was able to finally kick out slightly, but it was like the most sick I have ever been.
Oh, Bill.
And I'm not throwing up. It's rather, I don't know if I'm going to live at all. And I've got to get home. And I'm 40 minutes away. And it was the worst, longest, most terrible drive ever. I felt so bad. I got home. The only thing I know is I got home. The only reason I know I got home is I woke up the next day in my bed dressed. So I know I got there. Hadn't had any drink, hadn't done any substance of any type. And if it had been the food, which is my only thought, well, then I would have been sick. I would have thrown up. I would have, you know, tomaine. Only thing is, I drew back when I woke up the next morning. The first thing in my brain was Posey, who's one of the most important, one of the most special people I know, going, this isn't right. And I went, well, I guess Michael was right. This wasn't right. Somebody was teaching me a lesson on this one. Second one, I with Vince, went a whole lot better.
Okay.
Although Christopher Sampson, the guy that was in one of those, you know, muscle Christian groups where they rip phone books, they had a final spot where the end of the show was the heels were going to handcuff him. And we're at a table read for this. And I've got Terry Taylor, Chris Kissin, and Percy Pringle are over there. And we're going through it, and the guy's going, okay, here's what's going to happen, you know, because this is his spot. This is his big Christian moment, the heels are going to jump down and steal handcuffs from a police officer. And Terry looks at me, and Percy looks at me, and I go, Christopher, no. Heels don't steal things from police officers. They're real people. If you try to steal their handcuffs, I would want them to shoot you. So we'll figure out another way to get the handcuffs out. Go on. And he goes, oh, okay. I thought it'd be cool. No, I said, no, can't do that. Then he goes, well, then they're going to handcuff me, and I'm going to talk about the, you know, the chains of a blah, 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 whatever, scripture, holy, whatever, and then I'm going to break the handcuffs. And that takes us home, and praise God. And and again, Terry looks at me, Percy looks at me, and I go, crap, you're going to make me do this again, huh? And they go, and they're nodding their heads, and I go, Christopher, have you thought about letting us take a saw and sawing through so that you can easily break the handcuffs? Because wouldn't you hate if you get to the end here and regardless of your strength, regardless of your passion and your belief, you can't break the handcuffs? And he went, no, I can do it. And at that point, Terry, Percy, and I clapped our hands, walked away from the blackjack table, and spin forward, he couldn't break the handcuffs. God betrayed him in that moment. Then the crowd was, I mean, and he lost everything. The whole message was gone.
Oh, God.
Everything is tanking. But I went to the back and I said, AJ, come out to the ring. And he had his son, AJ, with him at this show. And AJ was like 3 years old.
I remember I was at that show.
Okay. And they did like a part. I had to start the show doing ring announcement because Barash and Jeff were late. AJ came out and did a parlor trick he did where he held his son up with one hand and his son balanced on his hand. And then Alan gave testimony briefly, very honestly, about family and faith and the stuff he believed. But, you know, it didn't have a bunch of biblical stuff and it didn't have pretense. It was just AJ. And the crowd was totally into it. That was our go home. And we were done. It was not what Vince had scripted at all.
Yeah.
But it ended up being what saved the show was Alan going out doing a true faith moment.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Bringing family and his son into play in that moment.
I love it. Phil, I got to say real quick before I let you go, where are you in Atlanta? Where are you in Georgia?
I have very few financial dreams. Like I drive a 2009 car with 200,000 miles.
Where
I
don't live.
I've got a condo I've had since the late 80s in Atlanta, which is where I am right now.
You're in Atlanta.
And then I have a house on Lake Sinclair, which is in Edenton, Georgia.
So when you're going to be in Atlanta and I'm driving through, or if we're coming through in the band, I have to find you and just do a really quick song with like a Beatles song because we could get.
Oh, I got it.
No, well, I think that would be a great promo. So when we are coming, I'm going to hit you up because we could record it really nice and just promo it for something.
My band tried to expand after we had lost all of our good musicians in college, and we tried to do Blackbird.
Okay.
And it was okay at best.
Well, I'm going to hit you up and we're going to learn.
The guy I sang it with did a good job, and the guitar player, which again, Mike Sager, was pretty good. But he wasn't great. And unfortunately, we were trying to do it very minimal. And we didn't have, you know, like, you know, we had a bad system. We just have to rent our system. For every time we went out, we had to rent a different system, different mixer board, different speakers, different everything. So you never, you know, we never knew where our levels were. We never heard ourselves. It was.
Yeah, I get it. The kamikaze on the run.
Bill, a lot of this. A lot of this.
All right. I'm going to find you. You've been amazing. We always close the show off one more time. Goldie's Closet, episode 75, Realm Network, Vince Russo's brand. Thank you to everyone who has made it this far and listening. We love you. We appreciate you. Bill, do you have anything before you go that you can pitch and plug right now? I didn't ask you that.
We're doing an outdoor show in Loganville at Burt Reynolds' old estate, Terra, which is pretty cool. I've always wanted to visit that. That's going to be next Saturday. Griff Garrison, now with AEW, is going to be there wrestling with Ben and Bull Buchanan as his partners. Bull Buchanan in WWE years ago.
We're
looking at probably doing a show for Anarchy, which is in Cornelia, Georgia, on August 15th. Hard to do stuff now because you really have to do it outside and you have to be really careful. Although last show I did, I wrestled in the main event.
Oh, God. Follow Bill at Twitter and Instagram. What are your handles?
Who knows? It's at my name, at William Behrens, and I'm Bill Behrens on the Facebook, and I'm on the Instagram, but I'm not a big fan of the Instagram.
Fair enough. They're still going to follow you, and we'll tell them to go over to Twitter. Put your hands together. You have to clap for everybody. I got to see your paws. Come on.
Okay.
Clap for everybody. Yay! And we're out.
Everybody, it's your girl Goldilocks, and we are inside Goldie's Closet. And I want to ask a favor of you all, whether you watch the show or not, if you come to our band shows, what have you, it's something that you can do to support, and it costs nothing and no time at all. If you shop on a very popular online website, I would really appreciate it if you would bookmark some of the items that you are shopping for. And if you could just simply do this, go to goldienose.blogspot.com. If you go over to the right, all the way to the bottom, the About Me section, there's a link. It just says I'm an Amazon affiliate. If you click on that, it takes you inside my umbrella. And everything that you order, I can earn just some help and support to keep all of this going, to keep the band going. We've got a hefty vehicle repair. It's pretty substantial. So it would be really great if you could remember my link. We get some support. It's that simple. I love you all. Thank you for making the time to stop by and check out everything that we're doing. Mwah.